Right, so hello everyone, and welcome to the In The Zone podcast with me, Mike Ryder.
And me, Josh Hughes.
And me, Ben Goldsworthy.
And you, Ben Goldsworthy. You've already beaten us to it. So, to introduce our guest to today's episode, we've got Ben Goldsworthy with us. So, Ben, you're a cybersecurity researcher.
Yeah, I recently finished my master's at this uni in cybersecurity, and now I'm working as a cybersecurity contractor.
Yeah, and you've been involved with us with our TTAC project, isn't that right, Josh?
Yes, you've contributed quite a few comments to various articles over the past sort of few months, and they're going up as we speak, right?
More to come,
yeah.
Hopefully,
some good ideas. Them.
So in today's episode, we're going to talk a little bit about e-voting. So this is something that you did in your master's.
Yeah,
research.
My master's dissertation was on how to develop for an e-voting system a side channel means of validating that it's all correct. So even if you put your vote through on a computer that was riddled with malware, you could then get your phone up, use an app, and then independently verify on a different channel that the vote had gone through, that the final count included your vote, and things like that. But the main takeaway I got from the year I spent on that project was that e-voting is a terrible idea.
Right.
And we should definitely think twice about introducing it.
So that's quite surprising, isn't
it? So when you say e-voting, you're talking of it in terms of, say, people voting at home.
So e-voting is kind of divided. E-voting, in the broad sense, is any sort of mechanical aspect to a regular vote. So it could even be tabulating paper votes is e-voting in the broad sense. I guess in theory, if you had like automated trucks driving the boxes of ballots around, that might be e-voting. Then you have direct recording e-voting, or DRE, which is where you actually press the button on the screen and that is your vote. There is no physical ballot,
right?
Which is the one that's very dodgy. And then you have i-voting, which is an extension of that, where you don't even have to be at the machine, at a polling station. You can send your vote from home.
Right.
Okay. Because, I mean, because that i-voting, then the more individualised one, sounds very good in terms of direct democracy.
Yeah.
As we're going to dig into, it's not quite as...
Yeah, I've got no problem against e-voting. If you want to tabulate your paper ballots with a machine, that's fine. But when you're getting people to press a button and hope that their vote's been counted, that's when you get into thorny issues.
Okay.
So, I mean, in our discussion just before we started recording, you were saying about it's very hard for people to feel safe in the security of the system, and that's one of the big things holding this technology back.
Yeah. So the idea, obviously, of any electoral system worth its salt is that it is transparent and fair and valid.
Yeah.
The result is however you've determined the winner based on the votes you've collected. So there's three properties you get for a sort of end-to-end verifiable system. The ballots have to be cast as intended. So if someone wants to vote for candidate B, their vote registers as candidate B.
Mm.
They have to be recorded as cast, so that ballot is as they saw it being cast. So they put their vote for candidate B, and then that is tallied in the overall total as a vote for candidate B. And then at the end, they have to be... I've forgotten what the third exact one is, but basically the final total includes their vote.
Mm.
Where the issue comes in with DRE voting is that the average person doesn't understand cryptography. I don't fully understand cryptography, and I've done a master's in it. There's horrible maths. What the average person can understand is people putting X's on bits of paper, putting them in boxes, driving them to a place, manually counting them, that sort of thing. And in theory, anyone can put themselves down to be an observer of a count if they, for whatever reason, have doubts about the efficacy of the electoral officials. When you have a system that's maybe actually more secure, because in theory you could fake ballots and stuff like that, but you can't really fake maths. In theory it's more secure, but very few people are able to believe that. They have to take it on the word of the very small cadre of people who understand it.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that sort of becomes a weird sort of... iVoting does have advantages in that everyone can vote no matter where they are, and it may have an increase on turnout, but that's not sort of settled. But you then have sort of 0.1% of the population who are saying, yeah, no, honestly, this system works fine.
Mm.
And everyone else is like, oh, okay, the nerd said it was okay, so let's listen to them.
Okay, so really kind of the issue is about trust.
Yeah, and the fact that, say, you have a small group of people, say, people who understand cryptography were more inclined to politically lean towards side A, then you sort of have an issue where all the people who know and can validate that it's working might actually have some sort of motive, whereas with a complete electoral system where anyone could watch, the idea is that you have so many eyes on it that even if there were some bad actors, it doesn't compromise the overall reliability. But with a very small group of like high wizards of the electoral system who understand the cryptography, if you had a smaller number of bad actors, they'd have a disproportionately large impact potentially.
Well, that's really interesting, because in some of my work on autonomous weapon systems, there's kind of a very small kind of bit of literature or collection of literature about trust in autonomous systems. One of them being about experts and how you could trust an expert, and if an expert says it works, then it probably, then everyone else might trust the system. But so it's quite interesting that you say actually this is the other way around when it comes to e-voting.
Yeah, and also experts will often have different personal motives.
Right.
So sort of the governmental policies that may benefit the expert class may not necessarily be the governmental policies that would benefit the working class dock workers or something.
So you mean like, say, a cybersecurity person who's invented an e-voting system and says this is really good,
yeah,
can then apply for more funding to say, oh, my project's really well, previous projects have gone really well, but then...
Yeah, in theory.
Is that the type of thing you mean?
It's more the case that, so any, you wouldn't have a e-voting system that didn't publish its sort of cryptographic protocols for how it encrypts ballots and how it decrypts them and validates them and stuff. And the idea is that the cryptographic expert community would then look at those and be like, oh, actually, we've noticed a flaw there. Mm. Or the software development community would look at that and the actual code of the thing, assuming that's open, and then say, oh, the protocol's fine, but your implementation here has a race condition or some sort of bug which could break it.
Mm.
But the issue is that's a very small group of people.
Mm.
And A, they might miss it because they are a small group of people, and like tens of years of security researchers looking at different platforms, and they're still finding these issues. So Google still comes up, they have a bug bounty program, they still get bugs, and you think, how many eyes are on Google, how many eyes are on
quite a few
e-voting system X. And then the other possibly less realistic but more damaging issue would be if that small group of people, say a large enough proportion of them, communally decided, okay, let's rig this election in favour of the candidate who says cybersecurity people will get free money.
Right, so it becomes politicised, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. Corrupt.
You have gatekeepers, basically.
Right, okay.
Whereas, even if that happened now, and you had all the people who go to election counts, once people got suspicious, oh, the candidate who keeps saying, I'm going to give £1,000 to everyone who counts at elections, he keeps getting elected, then anyone could say, okay, I'd like to go observe my local election.
Okay, so it's trust in two ways then. Trust that the experts who could evaluate the system know what they're doing and they're good enough. And also that they're honest.
Yeah.
Right, okay. Fascinating. Yeah.
But what's also interesting, I thought, from an outsider's point of view, is that the actual current electoral system, do we really trust it as it is now? I mean, would the electronic system still be better anyway? I mean, there's a question. Is an electronic system better versus, as well, is our current system any good as a system? Because, I mean, you say you can go and watch, but, I mean, how many people do go and watch?
Yeah.
Is that, I mean, that's, in a sense, just a bit of an illusion. And I say, well, I have a trust on ticks on the paper. But we all know that people sort of manipulate the voting system as it is.
Do we?
Well, they do, don't they? I mean, you see these things about election lists and sort of people in care homes and sort of voting, inverted commas, or being shipped.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, there's certainly flaws in the current system. But there's a sense of don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. So there are flaws in it. And to an extent, they can be mitigated. To an extent, they're kind of endemic in any non-DRE voting system. So anyone can go to a count. Will most people know? Do most people vote? I think actually in the UK they do. It's like 60% turnout at a big general election.
Something like that, yeah.
But the idea is that they can. So anyone can go to a court, and we have open justice as a big pillar of Western democracy, or whatever you want to call it. But that doesn't mean most people are spending their weekends at the magistrate's court watching low-level crimes get sentenced. But they could do. And there could also be people working for local press whose job it is to go there and act as sort of a filter. But they can also be held to account by the fact that if their reporting doesn't seem to gel with what people think, they could go and check for themselves. So it's kind of the possibility of the solution is there, even if it's not currently been taken. I don't know any figures on it, but I imagine there's a reasonable level of trust in the UK in the veracity of our electoral system.
Right.
So most people don't feel the need to. If there started to be big concerns, so suddenly you start seeing people with 99% of the vote in their area, then you'd get people thinking, oh, actually, maybe this is very suspicious, I'm going to go along to the next one, observe the count. But it's a lot easier to say, I had doubts about this last election, so I'm going to go to the next count and watch people fanning around with bits of paper, than it is to say, I had doubts about the last election, I'm going to become degree level experience of cryptographic protocols.
Yeah.
And advanced mathematics, and then validate the protocol, and then learn software development, and then validate that the implementation of the protocol is correct.
I suppose, because if we're going to...
Empowers the little man, paper ballots.
Well, I suppose if you had to learn all of that stuff, then, and, well, yeah, because if you're relying on the experts who know cryptography and software development, then it's not open in terms of, it's not an open democracy. Well, it is open democracy in theory, but it's not in practice because... who's got the time to go and get to the level that is required.
Yeah.
So is the level required really like PhD level or is it?
It depends on the complexity of the protocols themselves. You might have someone who's an absolute whiz. I was never so strong on the math side, so maybe I just found it. But you're certainly more than you'd expect John Q. Public or Jane Q. Public to understand or really to be able to just pick up in the same sort of intuitive way of X on paper, paper in box, paper counted, paper in pile.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty simple, isn't it?
Yeah.
So do you think do you think there's no future then for EVO voting just because it's too hard for people to
So as far
understand?
As DRE voting and iVoting, there's a potential, so Estonia is often held up as one of the examples of successful iVoting.
Yeah, but isn't that because of their history with cyber attacks from Russia?
Partly, yeah. I think they introduced it in 2008, but I might be completely off there. But one of the reasons that Estonia works where it wouldn't work in the UK is Estonia has mandatory national ID cards where you scan.
Which
I don't know if you remember, but they tried to bring that in the UK and it didn't go well, and they're never going to get that in the US. They can't even take guns off people. So there's a very different sort of infrastructure there, whereas we don't have that same sort of so they've kind of already trusted, like, okay, this government system, cryptography works. They potentially have, I think, something like 99% of government services are all done through that card digitally. So they have a lot more of an established thing there. I don't know if, I imagine they might have more trust in their government if they let that sort of go ahead. But there are use cases for iVoting, sort of minority use cases. So implementing it as a whole countrywide system or as an option for all of them, which I think the Speakers Commission on Digital Democracy said by 2020 it wanted e-voting as a, or i-voting rather, as an option for all UK elections. That's probably not going to happen because there's been basically no real efforts to push that in the UK. But having it as an option for all of them, not necessarily the best idea, but there are situations though, soldiers serving abroad. Texas allows iVoting for astronauts stationed in space during an election, which I think are the only sort of ballots in the US that are transmitted. Sort of in theory, a bad actor in the NASA control center could intercept and read what astronaut man is.
All of two or three votes.
Yeah. But those are the ones where even if that system got completely compromised, it's not going to throw an election unless it was between one vote, in which case blame the astronauts. But and the other issues depending on the geography of a country. So if there's a lot of people living in very remote areas, perhaps the trade-off of people might not be able to fully vet the voting system pays off against people might not be able to vote at all if they can't get to a polling station, which is up a mountain. But I think for the UK, which by and large has pretty functional infrastructure, plenty of village halls and schools that can serve as polling stations, it's not really a necessary improvement for the overall voting experience. but it does then have those attendant issues, which are, bad idea. Don't do it, speaker.
So, obviously, you're talking about the culture in Estonia being an important factor as to why it sort of does work there, because they're more trusting already. They're already... Do we think maybe as our culture continues to change, that maybe sort of 20, 30 years down the line, this might then become something we're more perhaps open to?
I would hope that our culture never becomes too fond of the government and is willing to let them do these sorts of things. There does seem to be a healthy level of dislike for our own elected officials in the UK, which I think keeps them in some degree of check. I don't know if Estonian politicians are just remarkably more trustworthy or just a bunch of stand-up guys and gals, but I think one element is that so with the UK you get about 400 years of cruft, departments established centuries ago that are still going, things like that. Estonia basically wiped the slate clean when they got rid of the Soviets and started again, and they set out with, right, let's be a really technologically advanced, like, fresh new country, which is why they've had such success with all this stuff, because they built the infrastructure completely on their own. So they have that sort of built into their mentality. So one of the things is, if any department of their government wants to access the data on you held by another department, they have to ask you first, and that access is logged, and the reason why they justified it is logged, and you can then vet that yourself.
Right.
Whereas in the UK, like a year or two ago, we had the... I can't remember which one it was. I think it was the Snoopers Charter, which had a list of about 28 government agencies, and it said all of these can access your data held by the other ones, and it was stuff like the Agriculture Standards Agency and Border Force and stuff like that, which then led to issues where, oh, actually, if you're an immigrant here, and you might not go to the hospital because you're aware that any data that you have that the hospital has is now accessible by the border immigration officials. Yeah. And I think you wouldn't get that kind of thing in Estonia. It just seems to... They built it from the ground up, that everything is quite well siloed. Whereas we would have to fight against the entire British civil service, which is quite a leviathan.
I mean, an interesting thing that I read on Trust a while ago is that often in... Well, it seems to be in the UK, kind of, if you don't allow people an opportunity to do something that shows their trust, so if you don't give them an opportunity to do something bad or good, and you don't see them choose the good thing, then you don't necessarily have trust in them. So if you don't give them that opportunity, then you can't build that trust. And because of kind of, I guess, with kind of the British kind of system, there's not the massive bureaucratisation of Westminster and Whitehall. There's not kind of those opportunities, because everything is so systematised. So actually, that's probably, might be, a reason as to why we don't tend to trust central government to the degree...
Can you name off the top of your head? You study a PhD in sort of politics.
International law, yeah.
A broad thing. Could you name off the top of your head the head of the civil service? I imagine I couldn't.
No.
No, that's a good point.
I think many people here probably could, unless for whatever reason their research was on the heads of the civil service. And
I mean, the old one used to be called Gus O'Donnell, who's... I only remember because his initials spelled God, and that was his nickname, because he was meant to be quite so intelligent and quite powerful.
And his name's Gus, and you don't meet very many people called Gus.
No, not at all. But anyway, that's the only one I know.
That is a good one, to be fair. Yeah. But that's sort of the point of the civil service, though. The point is that you're not supposed to really see the workings of the mechanisms of government.
The grey men and women.
Yeah. And I was just thinking, I mean, what struck me talking about that was this sort of the whole, these petitions you get now, you know, for raising bills in Parliament. And they're becoming a bit of a thing, aren't they?
Yeah, 6 million votes, 6 million
e-signatures
to revert Brexit, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, where do we stand with regards to that and how that fits in with Parliament and democracy?
So as far as the e-petitions go, I'm sure there are some that have led to some sort of action, but it would have presumably been something quite uncontroversial and easy to implement and get a quick win. Because any of the ones that get to the stage where, oh, Parliament will discuss this, they always seem to discuss it and say, no, that's dumb.
Right.
So examples like repeal the Snoopers Charter, that got discussed and they shot it down, which kind of goes back to the largest protest in UK history was the Stop the War Coalition before the Iraq War, and the Iraq War still happened. So there's a sense of that, okay, we're listening to you, but only within these bounds, and if you say anything crazy, like, will shut you up.
Mm.
But there is a way, you could use that system perhaps to, I don't know how much I want to throw referenda to the country over and over again.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree completely.
Quite a poor job of it, but Switzerland makes it work.
Yeah, it's just an interesting one because obviously it's becoming more well known, especially with the whole sort of Brexit thing going on. But then also there's loads of problems with it because obviously we could each make a dozen email addresses quite easily to register a dozen votes each. So if we can do it, anyone can do it.
I think that shows how little power those petitions have. Mm. There isn't more security around it.
Mm.
So it's kind of like, oh, okay, 100, a million, whatever the threshold is, a million people and maybe bots have told us to bring back capital punishment.
Mm.
Okay, let's tick the box, appease the Daily Mail readers, and then not do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, something that I was thinking, though, was in terms of i-voting, and maybe if referenda were always, to the, everything was in a referendum to the country, and it was i-voting and on an individual basis where you just use your phone, you know, it might lead to like the casualisation of voting, and people just can't be bothered because, oh, it's just another thing. And
yeah, it's like, oh, fucking hell, seven more votes on my phone today. I'm just going to click yes to all of them.
So in that way,
sure, I want all of those things.
Yeah, so in that way, like, you know, an attempt at pure direct democracy, I guess, technologically named pure direct democracy, would probably fail because people just can't be bothered.
Hmm. I think, so I mentioned Switzerland. I've heard sort of discussions about, because they are engaged in politics constantly, they have these referenda quite regularly, the people haven't, there's a sense that representative democracy means that the non-representatives can sort of get lax in their understanding of politics and that.
Right, okay.
So then when you do throw them a random referendum, they're like, oh, bloody hell, I don't know what I'm doing. Okay, I'm going to vote this one because the nice men said it was the best one. Whereas if you constantly have that sort of democratic engagement, it's incumbent on people, if they want to engage, they could just ignore it unless you do an Australia and make it mandatory to vote. But they have to kind of keep up to date on what's happening because they are their own representatives. And if they don't, they're screwing themselves over.
Right, okay.
I mean, this is obviously the fundamental problem with democracy, voting, all this, full stop. Because I always when I have these discussions with others, I always mention my nan. So my nan, like, for the last 15 years of her life, didn't leave the house. And her voting decisions were made based on the quality of a haircut of, like, whoever happened to be on telly at the time. And I always used to argue with my friends, well, I can go out and do as much research as I like on whatever. I can go in really armed with all the facts. I can make a decision based on my critical understanding. But ultimately, an old lady who hasn't left a house in 15 years can have a vote that's worth exactly equal to mine and then vote opposite just based on the fact she doesn't like their hair.
Yeah.
And that just sort of throws politics into a weird light, doesn't it, when you realise that the system is so sort of skewed.
I suppose partly the idea is that democracy struggles at scaling.
Mm.
So you have a small group and it's quite easy to vote and come up with things and for everyone to be educated on those things. You have 60 million people or 68 million in the UK and it becomes difficult for me to know what the burning issues in Penzance are.
Yeah, and to deal with them as well.
Yeah, which is why we sort of get to that representative level. But then we randomly throw it back and things go a bit crazy because all the people in Penzance who have been ignored for however many years decide to throw a spanner in the works. But I think the idea would be when you said that your nan votes based on haircuts and doesn't leave the house and you do your research and that, you've done your research, you've convinced yourself of whichever side, and then it, in a sense, in a democratic society, we're all in it together. It's your job to go out and talk to your nan and be like, oh, have you considered like voting for this one?
Different haircuts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even if it's a case of talking to Nan and winning her over to your candidate's haircut, it's still, if you believe in that as the right option, you should tell the world.
Yeah, that's
interesting.
People should
discuss politics more.
Perspective.
Which is, I don't know if we're going to go on to it later, but sort of free speech-wise, when people are afraid to discuss politics in case they argue, I love arguing, but some people don't. But you need to have people of different views arguing and debating. You might not change each other's minds, but you might change someone in the audience's mind.
Right.
And then their vote is also worth the same as yours and the same as the person you're debating's.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I heard the other week was that when it comes to your opinion, if you believe it to be right, and, you know, properly right, not just because, oh, well, that sounds right, you know, you've actually researched it, then you owe your community to tell them and to try and convince them or to at least inform them.
Imagine being surrounded by people and you know they're wrong or you think you know they're wrong and you just don't tell them. Like, what a dick.
Yeah, but then your community owes you to make sure that it's the right opinion. To you know, say, oh, well, this bit's you're not right there, or have you thought about this, or have you read that, or whatever.
Yeah.
So in that way, so it's about this thing that I was reading was sort of saying that, well, the classic thing of you influence your community and the community influences you, and so it's kind of meant to be, you know, this ever increasing good circle and process.
And everyone slowly grows in intellectual wealth.
That's the hope, isn't it?
It's a marketplace of ideas.
But it doesn't work like that. We all know it doesn't work like that.
No, but then what's the best we can do?
The solution would be, oh, you don't know enough. You don't get to vote.
No. I was being a bit sort of flipping in the sense of, well, because it is a strange system, really, when you think about it, that this is how voting works.
Well, the start of my dissertation was a lengthy discussion of the origins of voting and whether humans are the only ones to vote, because I think I went on a bit of a tangent. I got bored of the actual topic I was doing and talking about. It was, so the ancient Greeks, which we always say, oh, they came up with democracy and that, they didn't elect representatives or anything like that. They'd travel for a day to the polis and they'd all discuss these issues and then make their votes and then go home. And positions were elected on sortition rather than election. So everyone who was eligible, which it being ancient Greece meant not the slaves, not the women, not the non-landowning males, they put their names in and then they get picked out at random. So it was basically jury service. And there's movements now, I think the Sortition Foundation in the UK is advocating for these sortition-based deliberative assemblies on the idea that if everyone has skin in the game, rather than having people who become an MP to be an MP, it's you're part of the community. Here are the benefits you get from it. You don't get attacked by roving bands of bandits. Here is your duties to it. You have to, when called upon, spend a year helping to manage it.
Yeah.
And also, when that year's done, you have to go live in it again. So try not to screw it all up. I think there's something to that.
I quite enjoyed jury service, so maybe that might work for a lot of people.
Still waiting for my summons.
But no, that's another thing you mentioned about, you know, you've got to go and live back in it at the end of the day. And when, you know, you see, I mean, everything on Brexit seems to be someone from the right and the left just having shouting at each other on, that seems to be every kind of news clip. And of course, they do have to live next door to each other or down the street from each other for, you know, till one of them moves, which is probably going to be a while. And it seems very strange to be in times where it's divided to the point of just being angry with other people because, oh, actually, our trade relationship with Europe is maybe more important than our integration or whatever. It's like, it's a big political thing, but does it really require to shout in someone's face?
I've even got friends who will casually say, oh, the gammon are mad or stuff like that, which is really bizarre to me because it's a racial slur, but in the sort of most casual way possible. But it still feels quite strange to just hear them dismiss these people. And I make no secret of the fact that I wasn't super Remain. I sported my ballot in the end for convoluted reasons. I'm not sure I still back. But it felt right at the time. But they'll just say that around groups of people that they don't know. And they don't know if two out of four of them were Remainers or Leavers. And it just seems very bizarre.
Yeah. I suppose the hope that at least the majority will make a decision is the point of democracy, isn't it?
And insult strangers.
Yeah, well, I think in a way that sort of nicely brings us to an end of sorts about e-voting. So I think in summary, it was e-voting not very good just yet.
Small use cases, but don't introduce it everywhere.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you very much, Ben. Cheers.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the In The Zone podcast with Mike Ryder and Josh Hughes.
For more podcasts and interesting chat, visit inthezonepodcast.com.